Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the dubious morality of the administrative state. And Richard, that is the title of a forthcoming book that you've written with the Manhattan Institute, which you also previewed in a recent piece for The Atlantic. So maybe just to establish our terms up front, most conservatives and libertarians don't care much for the administrative state. Most everyone else has absolutely no idea what it is. What do we mean when we're talking about the administrative state?
Well, the first thing to do is to put the word modern right there in the middle, because the administrative state essentially has always had two kind of functions. One have been largely ministerial. You want to collect property taxes, you have to have an accurate account of what the addresses of various properties are going to be. You want to issue motor vehicle licenses, you have to have somebody who can start to do a tax. You want to collect money through the Internal Revenue Service, somebody has to be able to do it. You want to put stop signs on a road, you want to give licenses, you got to do all of that. All of the things that were associated with the creation of infrastructure and funding for the laissez-faire state are part of administrative law. And there's nothing in my book which is designed to sort of question their legitimacy in the abstract. You can find in any complicated system, which is replicated thousands of times across the country, some instance of a bad or untoward administrator. In Illinois, we have a habit of governors taking bribes from people to deal with such things as a chauffeur's license, a motor vehicle licenses for trucks, and so forth. These are not arguments against the administrative state. These are arguments against abuses that are in a state which is necessary. The modern administrative state goes far beyond all of that, because what it's prepared to do is to impose all sorts of regulations on the kinds of things that would never have been regulated earlier on. So, for example, labor is perhaps the most conspicuous kind of arrangement. The traditional rule was all contracting was at will. I don't want to deal with you. You can't force me to deal with you. You don't want to deal with me. Au contraire. And these contracts could be at will, meaning you could terminate them at any time, with or without any side payment and so forth. Come the modern statutes, you get hours and wages. You get time and hour, but minimum wages and overtime statutes. You get unionization statutes. You get family leave statutes. The number of relationships put on top of that particular contract turn out to be enormous. For every one of these things, you have to have an administrator. So the definition of what counts as an hour can take up, you know, several hundred pages of statutory and regulatory text under the Fair Labor Standards Act. When you pass these particular statutes, it's kind of a necessity to have some degree of delegation on very large problems. So you ask, who is an employee under the Fair Labor Standards Act? The statutory definition is it somebody who works for an employer. And you don't know whether that's a sick joke that you want to put on television or the best they can do. It turns out it's the best that they can do, because they're going to have all sorts of permutations. And the question is going to be something versus an employer. Am I a student or am I an employee? Am I an intern or am I an employee? Right? And you keep going through these various kinds of permutations. And labor markets are incredibly complicated. And there are all sorts of endless issues. So the biggest one is, am I a contract, an independent contractor, or am I an employee? There's going to be a 9-part test that you have to satisfy, and each state can confuse it in different, move it in different directions. It turns out you've got, you know, thousands of people who may fall into these categories. Do you have a per se definition? Do you have a case-by-case definition? What are you going to do with Uber drivers and Lyft drivers on the one hand? What are you going to do with people who drive in the construction industry or work in Microsoft as programmers or stringers on newspapers? The labor market has endless proliferation and subtleties. You put this statute on top of it, and all of a sudden, everybody has to be collapsed into two categories, and you can't do it by agreement, because everybody will agree that I don't want to be regulated. So it has to be done independently by the state. And so I actually wrote a very long essay on the regulatory hour, about 120 pages, going through all the endless permutations of what it means to talk about an hour or an independent contractor. So as your ambition starts to increase, it turns out that the complexity starts to increase, and we do not have the rules of delegation or enough understanding of these industries to do these things in a correct or sensible fashion. So the modest administrative state of the pre-New Deal era is pretty solid. The modern administrative state, which goes far beyond it, is highly troublesome.
So, Richard, tell us about the title of this book. I mean, this is obviously a piece of very sophisticated legal analysis, but you introduce this ethical element in the title, the dubious morality of the administrative state. What do you mean by that? Why is that important?
Well, it turns out there was a famous article that was written, or book written by Lon Fuller, about, I guess it's about 55 years ago, 1964, called The Morality of Law. And what Fuller tried to express was the view that you had certain rule of law values that every legal system had to incorporate, regardless of its substantive ends. And these were rules that you could not subject people to retroactive laws, complex laws, contradictory laws, and so forth. You had to give them some kind of notice of the charge against them, and so forth. And the theory that Fuller had was, if you have any legal system whatsoever that fails on these particular kinds of essentials, the system is not going to qualify as one that works. And Fuller essentially was writing about a much earlier and easier situation. He basically posited a monarch called Rex, and he was handing down decrees. So we didn't have legislature, and we didn't have delegated authorities to administrative state. It was a kind of quasi-philosophical explanation of what it is that we started to need in order to preserve the principle of justice. And Fuller himself was, I think, not a moral relativist, which is particularly there. On the other hand, Fuller, like so many people who wrote in 1964, had two things going for him. He had some kind of a private law background. Fuller was a very important scholar in the contract law for some 30 years before that. But he had only a passing acquaintance with the modern administrative state, because in 1964 that wasn't the thing that he wrote about. Well, in 2018 there was an article that was written by Cass Sunstein and Adrian Vermeule called the Morality of Modern Administrative Law in the Harvard Law Review. And the argument that was made in that particular case is, if you look at the Fuller virtues and try to superimpose them on the administrative state, you will see that it actually meets, where appropriate, all of those various kinds of situations. And I look at administrative law and I said, no, this is not a very good fit. You may be able to justify the administrative state, but you certainly can't do so in sort of narrow rule of law terms, because we get too much deference into the system. The rules are too complex. They're multifactorial. They're often retroactive, and so on. And so what I try to do is to sort of write it from a counterpoint to this. And then I realized as I was writing it, it's not just enough to say that you've got these problems. What you have to do is to explain how they arise and what ought to be done to solve them. So originally, I thought I was writing a jurisprudential treatise only. The title is still good, but the difficulty, it turns out, with the administrative state really becomes very explicit when you start looking at particular statutory schemes that are enacted and see how difficult it is to find some coherent way to put them into place, even if you have the best of intentions. So that what you discover, in effect, is as your aspirations to make the world a more just and complicated place takes place, necessarily the level of administrative discretion you're going to have to accept becomes very, very much larger. My favorite illustration of this is, what do you do in terms of the allocation of the spectrum? And this was a very big issue around 1920, because radio was coming on, and there had been a statute in 1912 which reserved some of the spectrum for the government and some for private parties. And then how did private parties establish their control over the spectrum? Early on, they just actually occupied a bit of it and started broadcasting. And there was at least one decision, a case called Oakleaves, which says that if you acquire first possession of a defined frequency in that fashion, it's good against the rest of the world, just like occupying a piece of unoccupied land. But the system became chaotic because there was massive intervention. And then Herbert Hoover, who was a progressive and was also, most people do not know, the father of American zoning, a progressive movement, called in all these licenses. And what he could have done was, one thing is simply say, okay, here's what we have. These are the frequencies. These are the people who get them. They can sell them. And it's just a property right. But he said, no. What we're going to do is essentially allocate these things and make grants to individuals, and they have to take it subject to government conditions. Well, then the issue is, what are these government conditions? In a famous case involving the NBC company, Felix Frankfurter opined that the appropriate standard that was developed under the FCC, now the Telecommunications Act of 1934, was the public interest, convenience, and necessity. And you ask, what does that mean? And Frankfurt is very explicit because he was a kind of an intellectual. He said it certainly means that you can control the rules of the road, but it's not limited to that. We can determine the composition of the traffic. So if you want to determine the composition of the traffic, you cannot possibly do that under a very narrow grant of delegated authority. So he says, we have to have this grant. I can't think of anything narrower that works, and the FCC will be able to figure that thing out. And sure enough, you know, the FCC spends forever trying to figure out what's going on, but there are no viable criteria of value that allow you to get unambiguous results. So within the administrative state, two things happen. One, you give enormous discretion for the actual person who gets it because you don't have any really coherent reason to overcome it. And then secondly, you develop a sub-rule which allows people who win the frequencies for a license to sell their license rights to somebody else to try to improve the overall efficiency of the market. And you look at the criteria that the FCC develops by 1961, and they're laughable. They simply don't accomplish anything. And so what you start to learn about this is if you have weak property rights, strong rights of participation, what happens is you get a lot of rent-seeking and a lot of politics. So the modern administrative state, which thrives on indefinite property rights, essentially then starts to create real limitations and handicaps on the efficient conduct of business. And Fuller had no idea as to how these things ought to be given out. He had a few desultory pages upon it. And interestingly enough, people like Bermule and Sunstein and Julian Metzger, who also wrote on that, they don't have a clear conception as to how you're going to do it. The correct answer turns out to be you try to create property rights and put them off to bids. Ronald Coase made this position in 1960-59 clear in a piece on the Federal Communications Commission. And long last, essentially, it's been adopted for some, but not all particular kinds of uses. So if you go back to the property rights model of the 19th century and carry it over to 20th century resources, you don't have to have the dubious morality of a modern administrative state.
For people who care about constitutional law and separation of powers, their interest in this issue should be obvious, but for people not so inclined, this could, one could imagine, seem a little abstract at times. Are there notable examples in recent history of issues people may be familiar with, may have seen in the news, where the administrative state was a significant factor?
Oh, God, yes. I mean, the most conspicuous of these cases has to do with the gig economy. As I mentioned to you earlier on, there was this enormous dispute as to whether or not particular people who work for Lyft and Uber are independent contractors making deals with a technology company, so they're not going to be subject to Social Security withholding, workman's compensation protections, unjust dismissal law, unionization, right? Or whether or not they're in fact employees. And the cases come out every particular which way. And so sooner or later, what you do is you start seeing people trying to put together administrative rules which would allow you to resolve this one way or another. And in California, a state in which all sorts of very controversial things are taking place of late, in the end, what they do is they said, here's what the court said we ought to do, and now we're going to create an administrative agency to figure out how it is that we put all of these things into place. And, you know, these are huge industries that you're starting to talk about. And the way they did the statute is they were not only going to have their administrators do this for Lyft and Uber, anybody who might conceivably be called an employee as opposed to an independent contractor was going to be subject to these kinds of restrictions. And so as you do watch the way in which the system unfolds, it turns out lots of people who thought they had settled business kinds of arrangements may find themselves sidetracked by the strong kinds of overlays that are coming. If you want a more profane situation, huge numbers of people work in shops, and they all are very much aware of what the overtime rules turn out to be. And they see the way in which their bosses stage their shifts, force them to leave, and so forth, in order to comply with these things. Well, the question of who's an employee under the Fair Labor Standards Act is extremely contentious, even with respect to ordinary kinds of firms. So I would say the administrative state on this touches just about everybody. In another area, you look at environmental law. There's a change here. No longer do you worry about stopping nuisances when they look as though they're really serious. Now you issue permits in order to build a house and so forth. So you want to take a case, a famous case called Sackett. Some guy has a piece of dry land, you know, maybe a half a mile from a river, and he starts to dig, and the government comes up and says, you've got to have a water permit on this dry piece of land because we have no idea what the interactive effects are. And, oh, by the way, if you don't get this water permit, we're going to fine you $36,000 a day for the non-performance of this kind of an arrangement. Well, people try to build homes all the time, and now what you do is you see this constant intervention of the Army Corps of Engineers and the State Departments of Natural Resources claiming that these guys are dealing with water. And anybody who has to file a permit today under the administrative state to build something with something within a mile or 2 miles or even 100 miles of a river or a lake knows full well the value of this particular issue and the size of the permit. The Waters of the United States Act, WOTUS, essentially could have converted most of American farmland into waters, which meant that if you wanted to do anything by way of construction on it, you would need to get some kind of a permit. There is no obligation on the permitting authority to give it to you immediately, promptly, or correctly, and very little attitude with respect to review. So anybody who has to see the word permit in their life, whether it's a building permit, a repair permit, a water permit, and so forth, they are living in an administrative state. And the standards in most of these cases are sufficiently nebulous that you get huge discretion on the part of public officials, which can make or break some kind of a business.
So the final question for you, I mentioned up top that the power of the administrative state has been a bugbear for people on the right for a long time. But up until recently, it was something of a cottage industry, and you are just now seeing it creep into more mainstream political discourse, partially because the Trump administration cares a good deal about this. Now that it's at least somewhat live, what are the real-world developments that our listeners should look to as to whether this problem gets better or worse?
Well, there are two things you should look to. The most conspicuous was something that happened just after I sent the book off, which was the Trump administration issued two guidances, which is sent, or executive orders, which limited the power of the state to say, I'm going to bypass administrative procedures of notice and comment. I'm going to announce a rule that is binding on myself. I know it's not binding on you, but by the way, if you violate it, we're going to sue you. And these guidances were responsible, for example, for the transformation of the sexual harassment rules, and they were widely used in industry after industry. And the Trump people came up with the proposition, you may want to issue one of these guidances, but they're not admissible in court, and you cannot enforce them. They're only informational unless you go through standard procedures. This is a complete rollback of everything that was done under the earlier administration. Another illustration is how you manage to read statutes. Everybody, I think, will remember the enormous brouhaha that took place in the city of Charlotte and in the state of North Carolina about the question of whether or not when you have children who claim to be clam transgenders who suffer from gender dysphoria can use the girl's bedroom if they're a boy or a boy's bathroom if they're a girl anatomically. And what the city tried to do was to create separate things. The Obama administration comes up with another one of its guidances announcing that these gender transformative kids are entitled to use the boy's bathroom if they want to become a boy. There's huge kinds of protests that take place by the parents. There's major litigation. There are boycotts by the National Basketball Association for this. And what the Trump administration does is, this was an executive order. We can reverse it. We're taking it out. And now how is this going to be argued in the courts? When this was, the Gloucester case was argued, it was argued with oodles of deference to administrative agencies. But recently, the Supreme Court, in a case called Kaiser, seemed to take the position, we don't have quite as much discretion as we did beforehand. So now that it's being argued as a straight-up question of statutory interpretation, and then no reference to the deference decisions at all. This will change the center of gravity. If you have deference, it improves the chances of the administration that wants to do this by 20 or 30%. If you don't have deference, it's a much more even game. And so the way in which one hopes to do this is you can't solve all the problems by having a rule of ordinary meaning for statutory interpretation. There's still too much discretion in the system. But what you can can do is to minimize one of the serious open wounds. And certainly, there are at least two people on the United States Supreme Court, the recent appointees, Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, both of whom are in different ways highly sensitive to these kinds of issues. So this time has come for this debate, and we don't know exactly whether this term we're going to have a blockbuster decision or not. But the long-term run for people like myself is, in just a simple sense, is as follows. You get really difficult questions of fact that need administrative expertise. You don't want judicial government spy-fecking the decision these decisions are made whenever they grant somebody a permit of approval. You just slow everything down. And at the same time, if they're questions of law, appellate courts can decide them as well as any particular agency, and you don't want to defer to them. So what you want to do is to treat administrative agencies more like they're kind of ordinary courts. On matters of fact, they get a lot of deference. On matters of law, they don't. And if you did that, it would also be a major situation. Make no mistake about it. So long as we have a big administrative state, we're going to have many more problems that we had before the administration state have gone modern. But if we can, in fact, first rule in some of these things and then make substantive reversals on some of the other stuff, which is more dubious, I think it would have an enormous positive effect on the economy.
All right. Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.